Next case is 06491, Columbus Bar Association versus Derek Farmer. Mr. Greer.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'm Dave Greer, and with me is my partner Carla Mormon, representing the respondent Derek Farmer, who is seated behind us. Two focused questions emerge from the panel's report in this case. Question number one, does the record support by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Farmer intended to mislead the disciplinary counsel and panel by denying that he told Mr. Martin and his family that the original brief filed on appeal, quote, wasn't worth the paper it was written on, and in his statements concerning his retention of an investigator? The second focused question is, does a failure to create and maintain contemporaneous time records constitute a violation of the disciplinary rules under the Code of Professional Responsibility? The answer to both questions is no. Let me start with the second question because I think it displays where the panel got off the track. The panel was clearly frustrated by the fact that Mr. Farmer, at the time of these events, was not practicing good defensive law practice and keeping contemporaneous time records. Despite that frustration and despite that admitted shortcoming, there is nothing in the disciplinary rules that turns that into an ethical issue. DR 2106 does not have that in there, nor do any of the ethical considerations under Canon 2, nor does DR 9102B3, which was invoked here. And indeed, in the proposed rules that we have, the comment 16 to Rule 1.5 specifically says that while it's advisable, it's not even made a mandate under the proposed rules. Indeed, this point is conceded by my adversaries, the Columbus Bar Association, at page 11 of their brief. They concede that there is nothing in the letter of the rules that require this, and the whole purpose of the disciplinary rules was to make very specific standards, the violation of which would become an ethical issue. It was the panel's frustration over that subject that led it astray, I submit to the court. If you look at page 25 of its report, paragraph 59, they note that Mr. Farmer never acknowledged that his failure to keep time records was wrongful. As such, the panel finds that he has refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of the conduct that underlies the panel's finding of disciplinary rule violations. And indeed, if you go to pages 26 and 27, they again point out that the problems that they have found Mr. Farmer violated disciplinary rules for are of his own making in that he didn't specifically document his time and effort in particular cases. Indeed, at page 21 of their findings, they go so far as to abandon the clear and convincing burden of proof that applies in a disciplinary case and say that because of his lack of time records, they will simply assume things. At the same time, the panel specifically found that he did expend considerable efforts on behalf of the two or the three clients that are involved in counts two and three. And those are recited in their findings of fact. They're summarized in our brief. There's a lot of effort that went into the $8,000 and $4,000 fees that were collected. So the answer to the first question is no. And it was the confusion in the panel's answer to that question that I think led it astray in the answer to the second question. There was a motion for a directed verdict before the panel that was denied, so that can be considered de novo by this court, as well as the backup consideration of weight of evidence. The clear and convincing standard is a significant standard, and I think you'll find, if you go to the citations to the record that were made by the panel in its finding on this intent to mislead disciplinary counsel, or intent to mislead the panel, or I suppose to mislead this court, the citations don't support those findings. The secondary finding about the investigator, finding 24 at page 14 of the panel's report, finds as a fact that, yes, he did hire an investigator. He did go to the trouble of checking and making sure the investigator was qualified, so forth and so on. And the finding of intent to mislead is then based on a citation to page 77 of the, or I guess it's 777 of the transcript. And if you go to that page of the transcript, what you find is something quite different and quite unsupportive of the conclusion that the panel reached. They're questioning Mr. Farmer as to the contents of the 4 or 5-page letter he sent to disciplinary counsel, which had originally investigated and dismissed any claim on this duplicate brief issue. Question, turn to page 4 and look at the last couple of sentences. It says, I obtained the assistance of a former Dayton police officer to help me with interviewing and locating witnesses to help exonerate Mr. Martin. Answer, yes, sir, I said that. Question, and you left the impression that you had the investigator go out and interview witnesses. That's what you told disciplinary counsel. Answer, no. I told the disciplinary counsel exactly what you just read, sir. But the truth of the matter, no investigator ever hired went out and investigated anybody in this case, correct? Answer, I did not say that in that letter. And indeed, when you go to that letter, which is an exhibit in the case, the next paragraph points out that before he could get his investigation going, he was fired by the client. So we've got an unsupported conclusion on intent to mislead. If you go to the other intent to mislead issues, paragraph 18.
Could you rewind the last one for me? I hope I was paying attention. Your point is that his letter said that he employed this person for the purposes of doing the following. He did not, and then he said in the next paragraph that he was fired before any of those tasks were carried out by the investigator. Is that
you have correctly rewound it. The quote that was made from his letter said nothing about doing anything other than retaining an investigator, which in fact he did and paid out of his own pocket the charge the investigator made. The next paragraph of his letter says that before we could complete my work, the client fired us.
Okay. And the charge of, or the allegation of being dishonest with the investigator or the person from the disciplinary counsel's office relates to that. That is the finding
correct.
Of the panel relates to that.
That is correct. And it also relates to the other issue which we need to turn to, which is this issue of did you tell him that the brief that had been filed was not worth the paper it was written on? Martin says that that's a statement that was made on May the 10th when he came to the prison, and at that time it's quite clear from the entire record that nobody had seen the brief at that point. It makes no sense that the statement was made. Mr. Farmer, I think, was telling the truth on both of these things when he denied making that statement and when he denied these things about an investigator. And if you look to the
well, counsel, is it true that he did, remove the brief that had been filed? There had been a brief filed at that point.
A brief had been filed by appointed appellate counsel.
I understand that.
Mr. Farmer had not seen any paper at all. He went to the home to talk to the family and hear what they had to say. He went to the penitentiary. Before he could make any judgment as to that brief, he would, of course, have to review the entire transcript and find out what are the issues they were talking about are in the record for appellate purposes. What are the issues that are only available on a post-conviction approach to the problem? He entered his appearance as counsel. The brief had been filed.
I understand
so
that.
So the time
then he withdrew the brief.
He withdrew the brief.
That was filed by the court-appointed attorney. And then he refiled a brief that was substantially the same brief that he withdrew.
That's exactly right. The reason for withdrawing the brief was that the time period was running, and had the state filed its responsive brief, he could have found himself in a bind where the Court of Appeals would say, as it has said in another case which is cited in our brief, too late, we're not going to let every time somebody wants to come in file a whole new brief. So that was the problem that he avoided by withdrawing the brief.
But didn't he, the panel says that he told the client that he was going to file a comprehensive brief, a brief that would be, I guess, more persuasive than the Nystrom brief, and indeed he didn't do that, and he told them, well, I ran out of time. I didn't have time. I got some other things. That's what the panel says. Now, he didn't tell the client. It was the client then that compared the briefs, according to the panel, and found that it was the same, virtually the same brief.
Well,
and he never offered to give him any money back. Isn't that the problem?
It would be a problem if those were the facts, but if you look at the panel's finding of fact in that regard and go to their citation in the transcript, you'll find it's non-supportive. And indeed, there's a lot of detail in our brief that I'll simply have to refer to by reference. But if you look at paragraph 18 of the findings, they say that in the initial meeting at the home, he led the family to believe that he could get Mr. Martin out of jail. And they cite to the record at 573, which is testimony of Martin's sister. And she does make that statement. She doesn't say anything about the brief at that point. But then as far as being led by anything, what she testifies is, we gave him money based on what he said he was doing in terms of my brother's case. She wrote a letter the following day to Mr. Farmer saying what he was going to do and what he said he would do would be to research and study the transcript and the other materials and whatever they gave him to try to see if there was any post-conviction or appellate remedy. That's that citation. They then cite that there's a subsequent meeting between the respondent and members of the Martin family where he asserted the Nystrom brief, quote, wasn't worth the paper it was written on, close quote, and there they cite to the transcript at page 450. And again, that's testimony of Martin's sister.
But, counsel, isn't that just a matter of credibility? The panel believed that the witnesses for the Martin family were telling the truth.
Well, it would be a matter of credibility if the citation that the panel relies on supported their finding, but it doesn't. What happens is when you talk to Mr. Farmer and he said that Mr. Nysom's brief wasn't worth the paper it was written on, is that what he said to you? Answer, uh-huh. And did he say that after he told you that he reviewed the brief? And she doesn't say yes. She said he had told us that, and then she goes on to go back to that initial meeting where he said he would look through all of the materials and so forth and so on. So it's not supported by the testimony. Plus, on the questions of credibility, there are six different things that I think required a directed verdict on this case, and certainly showed that the testimony of Martin and his sister are simply not credible.
Well, counsel, what would you like the court to find today?
I think you should find that there is no basis for any disciplinary violations on the part of Mr. Farmer, and that the matter should have been dismissed.
Okay.
Indeed, one of the overarching issues in this case, it seems to me, is that in order to come to any other conclusion, you have to take what is in post-conviction cases essentially inadmissible and incompetent testimony and turn it into clear and convincing proof in disciplinary cases. We've cited the cases on that subject, I think, at page 26 or so of our opening brief, and there's been no response to those cases. I'll reserve whatever time I have left, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Mr. Sherman.
Good morning. Myself and Bruce Campbell are here on behalf of the Columbus Bar Association Professional Ethics Committee. We have filed an objection to the panel's recommendation and sanctions in this case. We have filed an objection because we believe that when a lawyer is found by clear and convincing evidence to have deceived a client, to have created hope in desperate and vulnerable people, to have lied to the disciplinary counsel, to have lied to the Columbus Bar Association, to have lied to the panel himself, and that lawyer has not acknowledged to this day any wrongdoing, that a one-year suspension with a six-month stay is wholly inadequate, because this lawyer, no matter what his background is or where he came from, needs time off to reflect to what had happened. He hasn't learned a thing. Now, the facts of this case, I believe, are as egregious as it could get. The Martin family was desperate. Their loved one was convicted and serving a long prison sentence. An appeal was pending. Mr. Farmer has circulated through the prisons a brochure that says he is an appellate specialist, that he is a champion of the forgotten, that he will fight for justice. He comes and he meets with the Martin family, and he tells them at some point in time, he tells them that the Nystrom brief is not only not worth the paper it was written on, but Mr. Nystrom should be ashamed for what he submitted. He tells these people that this lawyer ought to be ashamed. He says that we, as appellate specialists, will file a new and improved brief, and all you have to do is agree to pay him $41,000. He tells these poor black people that if they pay him $41,000 in payments, he will give them a new and improved brief. 3 months pass. Mr. Farmer withdraws the brief. 3 months later, without a word, without a warning, without anything from the family, Mr. Farmer files what? He files the exact same. I saw it. I'm a criminal defense lawyer for a number of years. That was a carbon copy brief. It contained the same typographical errors. It contained the same miscitation. He miscited the aggravated robbery statute, which was a key component of that case. If he had done 1 minute of research, he would have realized that citation was a miscitation. He submits it. Does he give the family any warning? No. Does he ask their permission? No. Does he tell them, hey, I can't find new issues, so I'll refund the money? No. He blindsides them. He sends them this brief, and he does it on the sly, hoping they won't figure out what had happened. When they do, and just imagine, they get this brief, and they're even told by Mr. Farmer that this brief isn't worth the paper it's written on, that it ought to be an embarrassment to the lawyer that filed it. Now, they agreed to pay a lawyer $41,000, and he files the same brief. And then what happens? He says, well, we'll do it on post-conviction. We'll get this case turned around on post-conviction. What he doesn't tell the family on post-conviction is there's specific deadlines. There's statutes that say there's a six-month deadline from the time of the filing of the transcript. Does Farmer ever tell them the deadlines had already been passed? By the time he filed this carbon copy brief, the deadlines were already passed. And what does he do? He runs around and he gives them a lot of lip service, and he doesn't do a thing. Okay, disciplinary counsel gets wind of it. They come and investigate. And what does he do? Mr. Farmer lies. He writes a letter to disciplinary counsel where he flat out lies. He lies about the reason he filed a duplicate brief, because what he told the sister, Martin's sister, was the fact of the matter was he got jammed up. He didn't ask for a continuance. He got jammed up on another matter. He couldn't do the brief, so he filed a carbon copy brief. He lies to disciplinary counsel. He tells disciplinary counsel in this letter, he tells disciplinary counsel, we hired a former Dayton police officer to interview witnesses. He tells him that. Then Columbus Bar takes over the investigation. We get involved because Judge Graham, the United States District Court senior judge, files a complaint against Mr. Farmer because Mr. Farmer is doing things that are question his credibility.
Counsel, what was the lie about the statement that he hired the Dayton investigator?
That was a lie. He admitted to the chair, Mr. Alkire, he never hired an investigator. He was trying to justify. What Farmer was doing is he was trying to justify his fees. These people had to get the sister had to get a second job to help pay Farmer. The mother of Martin had to leave retirement to go out and get work so she can help pay. They're trying to pay this $41,000 because they believe and they trusted him when he said that he will bring them justice. They believed in that, and he turned around and he doesn't do anything. So disciplinary counsel wants to know, what did you do for this money? You don't have a fee agreement. You don't have a contract. You don't have an engagement letter. You don't have a trust account. We don't have any accounting. Tell me what you did. Well, we hired a Dayton investigator to go out and interview witnesses. That's what he tells them. He admitted. First of all, he tells that lie to disciplinary counsel. Then he tells that same lie to Columbus Bar Association. Then he introduces this document, this piece of evidence he knows is a lie, he introduces at the hearing. Alkire, the chair, calls him on it, and he admits under oath, he finally admits that no investigator was ever hired, no investigator ever interviewed any witnesses. The whole thing was a fraud.
So when Mr. Greer says the record would support a conclusion that an investigator was hired but did not have an opportunity to do his or her work because the client fired Mr. Farmer, that the record does not support that.
No, the record is clear that he admitted that he never hired an investigator. I don't think he never produced any documents that he showed that he hired any investigator. He admitted that he didn't hire an investigator, and he just took this money. So the Martin family says to them, hey, you know, they finally figured out they've been had, and they say, okay, Mr. Farmer, we want an accounting of what you did, and we want a refund for unused retainer. He doesn't give him anything. He doesn't give him anything. And I think what's particularly telling is Charles Martin, and this is in Relator's Exhibit, it's actually Relator's Deposition Exhibit 2 of the Martin Deposition, and it's Exhibit 5. When the family and Mr. Martin tell Farmer, we don't want you anymore. We want accounting. No accounting was ever given. No refund was ever offered. No explanation was ever provided, except we're going to do post-conviction where time limits expired.
Counsel, how much money was actually paid to Mr. Farmer?
Approximately
$9,000.
$9,000.
Counsel, you're a specialist in this area. What were Martin's chances?
Zero. Okay, if you read the brief, and I have tried, I think Justice Stratton will tell you, I've tried 25 death penalty cases, let alone, I can't tell you, over 100 murder cases. You read the transcript, it's a dead bang loser. It's a dead bang loser from word go. There's no post-conviction reading. He tries to put a spin on this saying, well, it looks like a drug deal going bad. That is bogus. That was bogus. This was a girlfriend of Martin that was murdered. There was Anita, I think her name was Johnson. She's an eyewitness. She gets shot. She lives. She runs down Salem Avenue. Martin's following her, shooting her. There's an eyewitness. And I want to talk about the eyewitness for a minute. Her name is Phyllis Mohammed, who sees Martin shooting. There's no suggestion whatsoever this is a drug deal going bad. That's what he's feeding.
So he shouldn't have taken the case at all?
Well, no. There was an issue that was raised by Nystrom regarding sentencing at the time. There was an issue. I think what you have to do, first of all, he tells him, I believe he's innocent. And in fact, he tells that to disciplinary counsel in his October letter. He's feeding these people. He's trying to build in hope for these desperate people. And he doesn't tell them.
In my years in the practice, I've known an awful lot of lawyers who do a very good business because they feed hope to clients.
for a $41,000 fee, Your Honor?
Well, some of them make a lot of money feeding hope to clients and agreeing with clients when the client's position isn't exactly reasonable or a winner.
The lawyer has an obligation to be honest and give a proper evaluation, and if the client says, well, I want you to pursue it anyways, there ought to be a fee contract in writing as how you're going to charge, under what circumstances, and what expectation. It is wrong, improper, and I think egregious to feed a client and their family false expectation, particularly in this case where you've got poor people who are going out getting second jobs, leaving retirement, paying farmer, agreeing to $41,000. But let me just tell you one thing.
So he should have just, upon reviewing Martin's information, should have just said there's no hope.
What he should have said at the time was, look, the case against him is very bad. There may be some sentencing issues. I don't see any constitutional issues. There's 2 months left by the time to file any kind of post-conviction. Post-conviction requires constitutional, specific constitutional issues. I don't see any there. I don't see anything, and I'm telling you, it's a long shot. I'm willing to try something, but it's a long shot. You need to know that. I want you to understand the circumstances under which I'm dealing with. I think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about integrity here. We're talking about honesty. We're talking about not building hope in people and taking their money under false pretenses. Now, let me just tell you one other thing, because I think this says volumes.
So how much money would you take after you told them all of that?
Whatever. You charge a fee. You charge an hourly rate. But the point is, they understand what they're paying for. These people understood they were paying for a new and improved brief, and what did they get? They get a carbon copy brief, and not only that, he doesn't give them any heads up. He doesn't tell them, well, wait a minute. He blindsides them, and if that's good legal work, then something's very wrong here. If that's the way we're going to allow lawyers to practice law, if that's the way we're going to let lawyers take advantage of prisoners and people who are downtrodden and poor, then there's something very wrong here. And I don't think that should be here.
I'd like to hear what you want to say about that document.
I want to say something real quick. In order to understand the Martin murder case, there was this independent witness named Phyllis Mohammed who observed certain things out on Salem Avenue, Charles Martin shoot the guy. Martin had in his mind that Phyllis Mohammed was lying, for some reason was lying, and that would turn the whole case around even though it was an eyewitness victim survivor. When the Martin family told Farmer, they wanted to terminate him in accounting. Farmer writes them this letter. This letter is January 2nd, 2003, and this is Farmer's response. And what he says is, I told you that I regret that you wanted to discontinue my services, especially in light of the fact that I had someone contact Phyllis Mohammed, and I thought she was willing to tell the truth in your case. This is a fraud. What he's doing is he's saying, if you fire me, I got this witness ready to turn around and change your story, which he never talked to the witness. He's telling the Martin and Martin family, if you terminate me now, this witness isn't going to come forward and tell a different story. This is a total lie. This is Derek Farmer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Mr. Greer, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Well, the theme of the relator's case was that the respondent preys upon the vulnerability of his clients. The panel does not find that this was proven by clear and convincing evidence. This is a case where it sounds to me like there's more a swearing match of counsel than there is in the record, and I think it behooves this court, while it's a tedious task, to review the record carefully, because I think when you do, you'll find that much of what you just heard is all smoke and no fire, and that, in fact, what you have is a case which should never have been brought in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.